his best smile. I have a wonderful ship waiting in the harbor.
Sailing? Asked the boy, clearly delighted. Can we go see the howler monkeys at home, and winged horses, and maybe a kraken?
Bronow crossed the room, still holding the boy. I'd prefer to avoid the kraken, Your Majesty, he said, fumbling one-handed to open the press. But there will be monkeys, even merpeople. Perhaps, if you're very good, a herd of winged horses. There's one on Imahin Isle, did you know that? He scrabbled through layers of clothes until he produced the cloak. Once the press was shut, Bronow stood Donovan on it and put the cloak over the child's shoulders, tying it securely.
Can't we go in the morning? Asked Donovan. This cloak's hot.
Bronow chuckled without humor.
Actually, sire, it must be now.
Uncle Rubinyon and Aunt Imogene want to send me to Karthak. If I go there, I'd never see my favorite little king again. I'd rather take you sailing now. He raised Donovan's hood and tightened it until the child's face was barely visible.
But it's too hot, complained the boy, flailing under the garment's heavy folds. I don't need a cloak. I don't want to go sailing now. Aunt Imogene promised I could have jugglers if I ate all my supper.
Well, I have supper waiting on the boat, said Bronow, picking the boy up once more. We'll find you jugglers even if you don't eat your supper.
Donovan, just hold still and do as you're bid.
I don't want to, wailed the boy, his eyes filling with tears. I want jugglers now, and my belly hurts.
Bronow clapped a hand over Donovan's mouth.
That's not all that will hurt if you don't be quiet, he snapped.
The two dogs had stopped their play when Bronow came in. Donovan's greeting had told them this was no stranger, but their manner changed the moment he began to cry. They barked shrilly, advancing as their young master fought Bronow's grip. Suddenly, Donovan shuddered with the effect of too many sweets on a young stomach. He vomited into the hand Bronow held over his mouth. The man reacted just as Ali would have done. He swore and dropped Donovan, holding his drenched hand out.
You disgusting little brat, he cried, trying to clean himself on a tapestry. You did that on purpose.
Donovan ran across the room, screaming as he wept. The door burst open, revealing a handful of guards. Beyond them, Ali saw a bottle of wine and a pair of dice on the floor, explaining why they hadn't checked on their king until now.
"Halt in the king's name!" cried one of them, fighting to get clear of his fellows so he could draw his sword. "Halt!" yelled another guard.
Bronow looked at Donovan. The boy was out of his reach now. The guards planted themselves between him and his quarry. He started to draw his sword, reconsidered, then fled through the secret door. The guards poured after him, leaving the sick king to scream alone.
"Is he mad?" whispered Ali. "He just tried to kidnap the king."
"Not mad, necessarily," Kiprioth's glowing form materialized beside Ali.
"Hungry for power, which Imogene and Rubinyon will never give him. If he can't get it here, he will try to find it elsewhere.
Those who search for him will bring power in their train, power they will bring to bear on anyone who tries to help Bronow. So now, Ali of Tortall, we come to the days when you shall win or lose our wager."
He stopped abruptly as two bright forms appeared before them, shining so fiercely that Ali shaded her eyes. They solidified until she could tell that they were male and female and make out their features. The man, black-skinned and powerfully built, a crown like the rays of the sun blazing on his head, wore gold armor and carried a spear. The woman was bare-breasted in the style of the priestesses of old Ekalatum, with a bell-like skirt hanging from its bodice. The crown atop her tumble of dark, wavy locks blazed silver like the moon. Immense snakes twined around her bare arms.
"Brother, what is it that you do here?" they demanded, their attention on Kiprioth.
Ali clapped her hands over her mouth to prevent herself from screaming. The divine voices and presences tore through her ghost-like body, shredding her like ancient silk.
"Mithros, he could only be Mithros," Ali knew, added. "We left you the seas that cradled this place and the seas alone."
His voice rolled like horses at the stampede, hammering Ali's ears. Daggers of pain thrust into her skull as she fought to keep from fainting.
"We have been occupied with affairs on the other side of this world. Now we return to find you in the Rajmuat Palace, which is no part of the sea."
Ali's mother had described the goddess's voice as the belling of hounds and the bugle of hunting horns. To Ali, it was more like the shriek of triumphant eagles and the slow, whispering glide of snakes on rock. Her knees wanted to give way, demanding that she kneel. She would not do it. It was one thing to kneel to the black god who would take her in hand one day. It was another to kneel to the pair who had done the Ra-Ka such a terrible wrong when they supported the Luaran conquest. Ali fought. She trembled as she summoned all of her willpower to stay upright. They were gods, but she was not sworn to them. She would not collapse in a heap.
"Should brothers and sisters suspect wrongdoing at every turn?" asked Kiprioth. "Are you so unsure?"
Ali kicked him. Later, when she was herself again, she would question her sanity and wonder how his glowing body felt the kick from her insubstantial leg. Right now, she saw only that all three brilliant heads turned their attention to her. She followed her instincts. She smiled, bowed deeply to the great goddess and Mithros, and said in a tone her father would know quite well,
"Begging your pardons, O great gods, ruler of we mortals, but I ask that you forgive my father's friend and patron."
Kiprioth had said he'd worked with her da, after all.
Remembering to speak only the truth, she continued, "At present, I'm deeply interested in the politics in Rajmuat, vitally interested, I should say. If my time here is to be well spent, I should understand how things work. These isles have long been a factor in Tortall's politics." She cut herself off carefully. She dared not play this too broadly, or they might suspect a rat.
Humbly, she continued,
"What am I saying? You are the great gods. You know what there is here to know. Forgive me, I beg. I am flustered, standing before you. Your divine brother Kiprioth is my father's patron. He has been helping me to understand the isles. Since I was stranded on Lomban with the mortals I presently serve, Kiprioth generously gave me this chance to observe the change in kingship."
There, she thought, wondering if her insubstantial face was sweaty. "I spoke only the truth." She kept her head down. The light of the gods' faces hurt her ghostly eyes in any case. Glowing fingers pressed her chin up and forced her to gaze into eyes as green as emeralds, as measureless as the royal forest in high summer.
"I can look into your heart, Alian of Pirate Swoop," the goddess said, her voice making Ali shiver. "I can see if you lie."
Ali stepped away from that hand, whose touch burned even her unreal body. Once again she bowed respectfully.
"Great Mother, you know I speak the truth," she said, choosing her words with immense care. "You could see the lie on me. If you know the family I serve, you understand how important it is that they know of Hazarin's death and Bronow's treason."
Not for nothing had she listened to Aunt Dane.
"Forgive me, Great Mother. I don't mean to be disobliging. Your divine brother Kiprioth knows the danger to the family I serve. He brought me here to see these things at first hand."
It was hard to read the goddess's alabaster features in the blaze of her glory. Still, Ali could have sworn the goddess raised her brows and pursed her mouth. Ali knew that expression from her mother. Alana looked that way when she had a suspicion that someone was not being honest with her.
"Your mother is dedicated to me," she pointed out.
Ali bowed yet again.
"That is true, great goddess, but I am too much like my father. I must follow his path in service to the trickster."
"You are very like your father," the great mother said at last, her voice shuddering through Ali. "It is the kind of prank he would play."
"No prank, goddess," Ali assured her. "What I do here is entirely serious."
"Enough," said Mithros impatiently, his voice sounding in the marrow of Ali's bones. "The Tisai on the other side of the world strike their gongs in the call for war. Their women beg you, my sister, for the strength to fight their city's enemies."
To Kiprioth he said,
"When we made peace nearly 3 human centuries past, you lost your eminence here. Do not think we will take it well if you break that peace."
"Brother," Kiprioth said reproachfully as he spread his hands, the picture of glowing innocence, "surely I know when I have been beaten."
The universe around them wrenched. When Ali could see clearly again, Mithros and the goddess had vanished. She looked at Kiprioth.
From the movement of his light shape, she could tell he was stroking his beard in thought. She poked his glowing ribs with her ghostly elbow.
"You owe me," she informed him.
"I know that," Kiprioth replied slowly.
"Well, never let it be said that I do not return favor for favor. Shall I free you from our wager? Take you home and speak to your father on your behalf? Then neither of us will owe the other."
Ali pursed her lips.
"How can I trust you?"
"I owe you. Even tricksters must pay what they owe."
Ali thought about it. To be home again, without this metal ring around her neck, to have Dag give her the chance she yearned for, those would be fine things.
The Scanran War was dragging to its end. Soon her mother would return, as would Aunt Dane and Uncle Numair and the baby. There would be hot baths and the newest fashions. As the warriors came home, the capital would light up with celebrations. Ali could read books, laze about, dress like a girl of property once more. She could even speak her mind instead of manipulating people. She smiled and shook her head, trying to imagine the butterfly self she was among the men of the court. Instead, she saw Winamine and Mequin, Sarai and Dove, Ulasim and Chenaol. Nawat would come back to Tortal with her, but Lokage and Junai would not, and Kiprioth had hinted Bronau would bring danger to Daenerys.
"No," she said at last. "A bet's a bet. You don't wiggle out of this one that easily. And if I win the bet, you pay what was wagered, and you still owe me."
Kiprioth sighed. "You drive a hard bargain, Ali." Before she could ask him if he was trying to pull the wool over her eyes, he swept her up in a glowing arm and shot into the air through the palace roof. They were on their way north again. Something occurred to her as they rose into the air over the city. Her mother was the goddess's chosen. Why hadn't the goddess known she was missing? Ali knew her mother wouldn't have wasted all this time, knowing she could call on the goddess and not doing so.
"Kiprioth," Ali realized.
"Why hasn't the goddess come for me?" she asked the god. "What did you do? You can't tell me that mother hasn't been praying to her for a glimpse of my whereabouts."
"I wasn't going to deny it," replied the god. "You know I dare not let my sister find out what I'm up to. I would be thousands of years coming back from where she and my brother would send me."
"One of my friends keeps your lovely mother company. She catches your mother's prayers and keeps them for me."
"You'd better hope mother never finds out, or you'll have worse than your sister and brother to contend with," Ali told him. "You don't want the lioness hunting for you."
"I know that," Kiprioth said. "I assure you I'm being quite careful." Ali said nothing more as they traveled. Instead, she reviewed the various combinations of results that might come from the events she had just witnessed. Bronau had planned to ask Hazarin to recall the Balitongs. Now Hazarin was dead. How friendly would Imogene and Rubinion be to the Balitongs? She dared not underestimate Bronau. He was now more dangerous than ever, as a man on the run and in disgrace, possibly declared a traitor. Whatever had driven him to such a harebrained stunt? Surely he knew he couldn't escape the palace with a 3-year-old, even if he did know secret passages. Why hadn't Bronau waited? Once his brother and sister-in-law were settled in their regency, they would have been less vigilant for unrest. Bronau could have gathered and bribed followers in his own time, ensuring his ability to seize power without taking unnecessary chances. Now he would be hunted the length and breadth of the Copper Isles. The new regents would view all of his friends with suspicion. The Balitongs would be among the first to draw their attention, since they had housed Bronau only weeks before. The Ra'ka would need more patrols at Daenerys. She would have to talk to Ulasim and Fezgau about that. With Ochabu and Ali to make sure no spies were brought into their ranks, the Ra'ka could expand their unofficial army. She hardly noticed when she popped back into her body. Her planning stopped only when true sleep washed over her. "You asked me why the king doesn't just call on the gods for help with Skanra. We mustn't get too dependent on the gods. On the day before King Jonathan's coronation, the great Mother Goddess spoke of a crossroads in time, when not even the gods can predict how things might go. At such times they must step away and let us deal with things. It's a blessing, in a way. It evens the balance and saves us mortals from being the gods' puppets. Still, it's hard to think of it as a blessing when you're frightened. You don't know why, and all you want is for the god to tell you what the bad thing is so you can hunt it down and kill it. From A Letter to Ali When She Was 14, from her mother. Chapter 15. Winged Messenger. When Ali woke at last, her muscles screamed in protest as she tried to sit up. Her mouth tasted disgusting. Her teeth felt as if they had a thick coating of slime. She was lying on a cot in a house that had whitewashed walls. How long? Her question emerged from her throat as a croak. She looked around stiffly. They had brought her back from Inti and put her into Nair's makeshift infirmary. Nawat, asleep on a chair by the door, was startled into wakefulness. He raced across to Ali and touched her face. "I am very angry with the god for keeping you so long," he said, his dark eyes worried. Ali smiled at him. "It was very instructive, though," she whispered. Nawat kissed her swiftly on the mouth, then raced out the door. When he returned, he brought Ochabu with him. "How long was I away?" she asked the old mage. Ochabu sat on the cot's edge and lifted one of Ali's eyelids. 5 days, she said. She checked Ali's other eye. "We carried you home on a litter." "You need a bath." She rose and looked down at Ali, her old eyes as unreadable as a god's. "Is it bad, what he showed you?" "Bad enough," Ali admitted. "I'll need to talk to Ulasim and the others right away. I don't care what they're doing. Are there graces about?" "The Duchess and the children helped Chenaol to put up fruit and vegetables against the winter," Ochobu replied. "The Duke is in the village. He oversees all the new building here." "They can wait until tonight, I think," Ali said, rubbing her temples. "But I need Ulasim, Chenaol, Lokage, Fezgau, and you as soon as I'm cleaned up. We need to prepare for serious trouble." For 2 weeks after Hazarin's death and Bronau's attempt to kidnap Donivan, Ali roamed. She covered Tener's castle and village on her own, then rode all over the plateau in the company of Sarai, Dove, and their guards. It was a relief to leave the keep each day. After hearing the circumstances around Hazarin's death, Ali's news about the change in government and Bronau's rashness, Mequin and Winamin seemed burdened, as if someone in the house had died. The adults understood that a nation with a child king was vulnerable to rebellion and trouble from its enemies. Sarai was furious that Bronau would frighten a child so badly. Dove's opinion stayed behind the younger girl's dark eyes. Ulasim had recruited another Ra'ka patrol, but the harvest had begun, and every hand was needed to bring it in. Tener winters were harsh. The crops had to be brought in and food laid up. Ali understood the thin line between poverty and starvation. Harvest at Pirate Swoop was always a scramble, one in which the Baron's entire family worked in the fields. Despite knowing that, Ali had to struggle to hide her impatience with the Ra'ka. Bronau was on the loose, with the regent searching for him. If she had an army to keep the Balitong safe, she would still wonder if she had planned for everything. Ali calculated the time it would take Bronau to reach Lomban. It would be a week if his passage was as swift as the Balitong's had been. To that she added a handful of days on the road, assuming he landed on the western coast, or a week if he came from Damari. When a third week passed with no sign of the renegade prince, Ali relaxed slightly. Perhaps Bronau had been captured, or perhaps he had decided that Tener was the first place his enemies would look for him. Waiting for something to happen, Ali met with the Ra'ka conspirators each night to review their arrangements and hear their news. She also visited Nawat to hear what the crows had to report. Only with Nawat could Ali enjoy the summer's calm. The nights were getting cool, but it was warm at Nawat's side. Once he finished with the news, he taught Ali the names the crows had for the stars, the different types of cloud, and the moon. The only thing that had the same name for crows as it did for humans was the constellation known as the Cat. "My mother knew the Cat," Ali confided. "At least, that's what she told me when I was a little girl. That the Star Cat became a mortal one and taught her things as she grew up. It was my favorite story, even if it wasn't true." "Why should it not be true?" Nawat asked. The cat is a god of sorts. He makes his own decisions to help or to hinder two-leggers. He put an arm around Ali. She leaned into his hold, not thinking, then tugged away.
"Now what?" she exclaimed. "What is that supposed to be?"
"Don't you like it?" he asked. "Fezgau does it to Tulpa, the miller's daughter, and she nestles against him."
"I'm not Tulpa," Ali insisted. "Besides, I can't be distracted."
She got to her feet hurriedly and thanked all the gods that she did not blush as easily as her mother did.
"Nestling is very distracting."
"I know." Nawat got to his feet, resting his hands on her shoulders. "You are Ali, who guards us all." He bent down and kissed her slowly and sweetly. Ali clung to him because she was afraid to try to stand on knees gone to jelly. At last, Nawat released her. "Good night," he said cheerfully. He walked out through the inner courtyard gate on his way home to Faltin. Ali remained where she was, a hand pressed to her lips for a long time. Realizing that if Bronow came they were as prepared as they could be, Ali threw her energies into the winter preparations at Tenere. There was plenty for everyone to do, from the Duke and the Duchess to the child who brought in the eggs each day. The older Balitang women and their 20 servants and slaves worked at the tasks of the season, boiling and jellying, peeling and cutting, grinding and sealing, smoking and pickling. Mekwen was everywhere, helping to get the crops in, the wood cut and stored, and making sure Tenere was weatherproofed. Like the village children, Elsrin and Patran helped their families. Each night Patran showed Ali her day's work, presenting the wads of lumpily spun wool with as much pride as if they were the finest thread. Elsrin collected baskets of pine cones to use as kindling, losing half of them on the way home. Weapons training was the only thing to continue uninterrupted. Sarai worked on more complex battle dances. These were combinations of footwork, thrusts, blocks, and chops, meant to be used until she could do the sequences without thought in response to a real attack. Winamin still labored to master the most basic battle dance, but she practiced ferociously, ignoring blisters and aching muscles. Dove's archery improved daily. She could now shoot a cluster of 5 arrows in a circle no wider than her stepmother's hand. All the same, Dove never got so good that Nawat couldn't catch her arrows. Ali grinned to see grizzled veterans consoling the 12-year-old, assuring her that they too could not lose a shot that Nawat didn't catch. One morning, as Ali rode out with her young mistresses and their guards, she noted clouds along the western edge of the mountains. "Let's make it quick," she advised. "We take the medicines to Pohan and back. That looks like rain to me."
"You worry too much, Ali," Sarai scoffed as she mounted up. "Those clouds are miles away."
"Ali is right," Fezgau told his mistress firmly. "To Pohan and back, no farther. Storms move fast up here. You should know this by now."
Sarai put up her nose and galloped her mount through Tener's open village gate. Ali watched Fezgau gallop after Sarai and shook her head.
"She'll calm down," Dove told Ali as the two girls rode out of Tenere.
Nawat followed them at an easy trot. Ochebu had commissioned him to gather roadside herbs for her that day.
"She just doesn't know what she thinks about Bronow going so wrong. The only way she knows how to deal with it is to ride hard."
Ali grinned and glanced down at Nawat. "I don't suppose you'd flirt with Sarai," she asked the crow man. "She thinks you're handsome. You could clean the bugs from your teeth."
"And you aren't old and stupid like Bronow," Dove added.
"I am too young for Sarai," Nawat replied soberly. "I'm not even a month old. Sarai is ancient compared to me."
Ali and Dove giggled.
"Oh, tell her that when I'm there to see," Dove begged. "I want to watch her face when you do."
They caught up to Sarai and Fezgau 5 miles outside Pohan. The other two riders had reined up at the spot where a barely used track met the road.
"Sarai, no!" cried Dove, exasperated beyond her usual calm. "Can't we just once go somewhere and return quickly?"
Nawat raised a finger, his eyes sharp. "Hold." Ali held very still, listening. Why had the usually polite Nawat voiced something like an order? Then she heard it, the raucous clamor of dozens of crows in the east. She strained to hear, but many of them called different things, some of which she had never been taught.
"What?"
she began. A winged four-legger comes from the mountains that hold the morning sun, said Nawat. She bears a fledgling two-legger on her back. They seek the stones to... the castle. Ali frowned.
Winged? A kudurung? A big one to carry a child on her back? That's a royal messenger, Sarai commented, her perfect brows knit in disapproval.
Only the Ritavan line may call on winged horses as messengers. I doubt that Donovan would think of using one unless he wanted a ride.
All three girls wheeled their mounts and raced to Tener, their guards on their heels. Nawat was left behind to make his way on foot. They had to slow to a trot through the village. By then, Ali had already spotted the new arrivals. A boy or girl of 10, clad in shearling garments against the cold of the upper air, strapped to a large gray mare with a white mane and tail and huge bat-like wings. Messenger and mount sailed over the girls' heads. With an adjustment to her sight, Ali could see the winged horse badge of the Ritavan family. They would never use the Rakha word kudurung on both the messenger's tunic and the chestpiece of the kudurung's harness. The pair sat down within the castle's inner courtyard as the girls and their guards rode through the gate. Ochabu's three tiny kudurung darted from the kitchen to circle the gray, looking like blackbirds against the thundercloud. Dove tumbled off her horse's back and raced inside to alert the Duchess. Sarai ordered Veron to find the Duke. Ali slipped off Cinnamon and took the three mounts to Locage and his stable boys.
You know what the Luarin say, don't you?
Locage murmured as he watched the messenger unbuckle the straps that held her to her mare.
Deadly news rides horses that fly.
Ali sighed. If only the Ritavans use them as messengers, I can see how people might think that.
The custom is an old one, from the time before the Kudurung were banished to the Divine Realms, Locage said. Our people had all but forgotten, until they returned 12 years past. Once the Kudurung came here in flocks, all sizes of them, to nest and rear their young.
Ali washed her hands in a bucket of water, the picture of idle innocence. To Locage, she said quietly, Someone implied to me they served the old Rakha monarchs freely, but that King Oran had to capture some and breed them for his service.
It was far-sighted of Oran. May we live to spit on his grave.
Locage grinned, revealing all the gaps in his teeth.
When Sarai takes power, the people will see the Kudurung come to her freely. They will see she holds the crown by right.
Don't say that aloud, even to a friend, Ali warned. The less it's mentioned, the less chance someone will overhear who shouldn't.
Cautious Ali of the Crooked Eye, said Locage with a chuckle.
If you keep sweet-talking me so, I'll charge you before the Duke of turning my poor frivolous head, Ali replied, batting her eyelashes at him. An incautious spy is soon dead. And don't start asking again who I was before I ended up here.
You think that others don't wonder?
Locage asked, his eyes glittering with interest.
That their graces don't ask how many tiny signs and tricks a god could teach a mortal in a short time.
What I think doesn't matter, said Ali as she shook her hands dry. I just live my life at the god's beck and call. Locage snorted his disbelief. Ali waved a lazy hand at him. Now, if you'll excuse me, I'm going to snoop. Once the Duke arrived, he and Winamine retired to their private rooms with Sarai and the messenger. They didn't ask for a servant to attend them. Ali idled in the great hall, restacking logs on the hearth, until Sarai appeared at the top of the stairs.
Ali, have Ulasim find this girl a place for the night, she called, urging the messenger down the stairs. Papa and Mama have asked for you to bring some wine.
Ali obeyed, summoning Ulasim for the messenger and going to Chenaol for the wine. When she reached the Duke's rooms with the tray, Sarai took it, then poured cups for her father and stepmother. Winamine offered the messenger's letter to Ali. All three Balitongs looked haunted. Ali took the letter and scanned it. The seal was the Ritavan's, a winged horse triumphant rearing on its hind legs, wings outstretched. The writing on the document was firm and elegant, though it was not in the professionally smooth hand of a scribe.
My dear Mequen and Wina, I regret that this letter brings no good news to you. King Hazarin is dead of apoplexy. Donovan, my lady's half-brother, is now king, with Imogene and me as his regents. That would be tragic enough. Hazarin was in his prime, and no kingdom ruled by a child is stable. There is worse news, however. My brother, in madness or folly, attempted to kidnap Don Yvonne, to what purpose I cannot guess. He has been formally charged with high treason. Our agents seek him throughout the realm. Already we have learned that my brother is attempting to create rebellion among the outland nobility. This cannot be allowed. I am concerned that he may seek refuge with you and your family, as he did when he incurred Oren's disfavor. For the love you bear me, will you ask him to come to Rajmoor to answer the charges? If he comes of his own accord, I may be able to smooth things over with the king's council. Should his enemies take him, I fear for my brother's life. He has always said you and Winamine are the coolest heads in the family. I agree. If you can persuade him to return, Imogene and I will be forever in your debt. We are reversing Oran's charges against you. Soon you will be able to return to Rajmoat. I cannot envision keeping the Midwinter Festival without my best friends there. With thanks from Imogene and from me. Your friend, Rubinyan. Ali reread the letter. Rubinyan says he's worried, she thought, but he never calls Bronow by his name or implies that he cares for him. And he doesn't ask the Balitongs to come home now, when he's as good as king himself, for all that he calls them friends. Does he want them to serve as bait for his brother first? She returned the letter to Mequen. Of course his grace will do it, she thought, watching the Duke's troubled face as he rolled the letter up into a tight scroll. He has faith that Bronow can explain his way out of this, or that Rubinyan will save him from the gallows. But he can also tell that something is not right here. Mequen tapped the rolled letter against his leg. He sent this by winged horse, he said at last. It's a private letter from him to me, but he used royal messengers for it. Is he mad? In the reign of Hanaran the First, it was ruled that no regent may take on the prerogatives of the crown. That includes the use of winged horses. He wanted the news to reach us as quickly as possible, with all the distance between us, the Duchess explained. He thought you would understand. And it does involve the attempt on Don Yvonne. I do not like it, replied Mequen. It is most improper. Perhaps Aunt Imogene wished us to get the letter quickly, and she granted the use of the messengers? Asked Sarai. She is as royal as Don Yvonne, even if she can't inherit. Ali folded her hands in front of her. Will your grace tell this to the household? She asked politely. Let them know that the prince's next visit may be... She chose her words carefully. Different, she finished. The Duke and Duchess traded glances. It was Sarai who replied. Is this the kind of thing servants should know? Ali looked at her. If the prince comes and there is a fight, they'll be involved, she pointed out. And some of the servants... She stopped. Light was growing in the room, casting the family and the furnishings into high relief. The source of it, she realized, was her. With a mental sigh, she silently asked Kiprioth, "Will you stop playing games?" "You want them to listen, don't you?" asked the god. "Keep talking." Ali resigned herself. "I must be sure that my next task in life can be handled without gods," she told herself. To the Balitongs, she said, "You have servants who will be useful if things go wrong. Ulasim, for one. Ochabu. Royal spy or not, Varon must be warned that Bronow may come armed with soldiers on his tail." Ali went silently to the door to the servant's stair to reveal Dove, who had been listening again. Ali beckoned her inside and closed the door. Lady Dove should have been here already to further her instruction about the world she must live in. "Dove, eavesdropping is a slave's trick," the Duke told his younger daughter. Dove looked down. "I'm sorry, Papa," she replied, though she was clearly not. Ali looked at the family. She still gleamed with power lent to her by the god. "I advise you only because I want to ensure nothing happens to you. I want to keep you and your children safe, and I cannot do it alone. I'm not the sort to go dashing around with a sword in each hand." The Duchess pursed her lips. "When you put it that way, of course we must listen," she said dryly. The glow that blazed from Ali faded. "Find those you think must know and send them to us here," Mequen instructed. "We will explain."
Once she'd found Ochabu, Veron, and Ulasim, Ali left it to the Duke to share the news. She wandered down to the kitchen. There, Chenaol and the kitchen staff were feeding the messenger, bombarding the girl with questions. Chenaol winked when she saw Ali. The cook would get any scraps of information the messenger might have. Ali nodded to Chenaol and went outside. Near the stable, the winged horse and Nawat stood forehead to forehead. Nawat's lips moved. Ali watched, fascinated. What was Nawat doing?
"They speak, as winged creatures will," Lokage said.
He had appeared at Ali's elbow.
"Whatever news the Kudurung has, Nawat will hear it."
Ali ran a finger under the metal ring on her neck. It bothered her more than usual tonight, having picked up bits of hay during her day's work.
"Annoying, isn't it?" Lokage asked. "Now you feel like a raka. Even those who do not wear a metal collar have felt Luaran rule chafing for nearly 3 centuries.
Ali raised an eyebrow at the old man. Here was another chance to make the point she had tried to impress on Ochabu, the greatest problem with the Ra-Kaz and Kiprioth's plans. "I know Luaran rule irks you," she replied evenly. "So let me ask this. Does it bother you that blood will be shed to remove your collars? That the Luaran who tried to do their best by you, who only inherited the mess the Ritavans have made, may die to ease the collar off your necks?"
"Do you speak of Our Lady's family or of Prince Bronau?" asked Lokage. "The Jimajen house is known for its brutality to the Araka. We will rejoice if Jimajen blood is shed."
Hands in his pockets, Nawat left the winged horse to the meal of oats Lokage had supplied and sauntered over to the hostler and Ali.
"She says that the winter rains will come late in the jungles," he told them. "The fishing is off. She says also that the free Kudurung know the old blood is present here, on Lomban. When the time comes, the Kudurung will gather to salute the new queen."
Ali thought this over. A powerful symbol of someone's right to rule was always useful. The appearance of the Dominion Jewel had once convinced Tortallans that Jonathan was the rightful king. She nodded. "Thank her, please. We are honored that the Kudurung will help us."
"It will be as it was before," Lokage whispered, eyes bright with awe. "The rightful queen and Rajmuat, and the Kudurung soaring in the skies."
"She isn't on the throne yet," Ali cautioned. "Don't let your dreams outrun your common sense." She took another look at the Kudurung, who had folded her wings as she ate greedily. Still thoughtful, Ali returned to the castle, absently running a finger around her slave collar. When Ali left the tower the following morning, she found Nawat at work outside as usual. Crows were perched all around the inner courtyard, on every space they could find. There must have been 30 of them. Nawat greeted her with his warm smile, the one that always got an answering smile from her.
"My clan will roost here for a time, until the weather says it is the season to fly down to warmer country. They say they will be sure to empty their bowels off the sides of this nest."
With a wave of his hand, he indicated the castle walls. Ali looked at the crows, then at the young man, carefully attaching sharp stormwing fletchings to a heavy arrow shaft. "Another mage killer?" she asked. For the first time, she noticed that despite his deftness and assurance, he always worked slowly with the razor-edged stormwing feathers. "There are all kinds of mages in the world, and sometimes they run in packs," Nawat replied. Ali nodded. Looking at the circle of crows, she asked, "Will we need so many?" Nawat bird shrugged.
"They are my clan. If they are not needed, they will watch the game."
Ali raised an eyebrow as she turned her gaze on him. "Is this a game to you?" she asked. Nawat looked up. His dark eyes held hers.
"You are never a game to me, Ali. And hawks are never a game to crows."
"But you aren't a crow now," she pointed out softly.
"A crow may put on human shape or crow shape, but we remain crows," he replied firmly. "Hawks, too, are the same, whether they are born in human nests or hawk ones. The nestlings must always be protected. Since you have chosen to protect these, I and mine will protect you."
Ali nodded, blinking her eyes against sudden tears. She couldn't think of a thing to say in response to such a declaration of complete friendship. Instead, She rested her hand on Nawat's shoulder. His warm fingers covered hers for a moment. Then he returned to his fletching, and Ali wandered out through the gate to inspect the Tener defenses. She walked down through the village, waving to the baker and exchanging greetings with the innkeeper's wife. Vishta and Eket raced by, surrounding Ali with goats and sheep. She grinned as they swirled out through the village gate on their way to pasture. Except for those early risers and the sleepy-looking men-at-arms on the wall, Ali had the ground to herself as she examined the village defenses. Duke Mequin had worked on the wall along with other projects all summer. Much had been done since their arrival, shoring up what was left of the ancient stone wall and bracing the palisade just outside. More than anything, Ali wished they'd been able to build the stone wall to the height of the log one. If an enemy came at them with battle fire, the palisade would burn, and the stone walls wouldn't stop anyone. Ali understood why more hadn't been done. The Duke could only call on those of his men-at-arms who weren't on duty and the few villagers who didn't have crops to harvest or winter preparations of their own. It didn't make Ali feel any better. She would just have to pray that no enemies came with battle fire, or that those who did fell into the ditch in front of the palisade. If they burned the wooden barrier, the villagers would have to retreat within the castle walls and expect to lose everything outside them. Ali trudged back up to the castle. Perhaps Ochabu could fireproof the palisade. She wanted to be certain the Duke could summon the villagers inside the walls and warn the valley herders to hide with their stock. They needed ways to heat barrels of oil or water and get them onto the walls to dump on any attackers. Enough, she told herself, leaning her forehead against the stone of the outer courtyard wall. They'll only let you do so much. His Grace and Veron will have plans laid to bring folk inside the castle and defend it. My job is to twiddle my thumbs and wait for something to happen. If I'm to do that, I may as well go sew winter clothes. I can only act on what information I have, as I have already done. Now it's a matter of waiting. I hate waiting. Kiprioth, she called silently in a teasing voice. Kiprioth, Kiprioth, Kiprioth. Don't pretend you aren't nearby. All this is too important to you. Talk to me. You are getting to know me a little too well, the familiar voice said wearily. What is it? Oh, don't be grumpy, she told him, still being playful. Isn't it a grand thing that I do know you so well? Now tell me, something's about to happen, isn't it? The reason why you brought me here in the first place. Well, demanded the god. What is it? Ali wanted to know. What's coming? I could use a hint. My working blind isn't precisely useful, you know. All I see is a coming together of lives and possibilities. Anything could happen. Just a little hint? You're a god. You must have some notion, she replied, prodding him. I do not. Suddenly the god's voice boomed in her mind, as it must boom in the minds of the Balitungs and the Ra'ka. Ali locked her knees. She would not drop to the ground, no matter how much Kiprioth sounded like a great god to her just now. She stubbornly remained on her feet as he continued. It is the hour of mortal choices. It is your turn to dictate the course of fate. I can do no more. Just when she thought he was finished, that he'd made his portentous announcement and gone away, she heard him say, much more quietly, Besides, my brother and sister have returned. Well, I knew they would. Don't betray my trick to them, Ali. Keep them thinking this is just another human squabble. Thanks ever so, she thought to him. I'll do as much for you one day, and you still owe me. When her sense of Kiprioth's presence faded, Ali sat at the base of the castle wall. She had her answer in a manner of speaking. Things, events, were unfolding, and now the humans would have to do their part. The gods had to let the dice fall as they may. Wonderful, Ali thought, leaning her head against the wall. Might I have the graveyard hag's dice right now? Aunt Dane says they're weighted with lead so the hag wins every roll. I don't mind cheating at a time like this. A shadow passed over her. Ali looked up to see the Kudurung and her rider in flight, on their way back to Damari. 3 afternoons later, the crows at the pass shrieked the news that 11 armed riders were on the road to Tener. Crows and a Ra'ka patrol followed them to the village to make sure that none of the visitors left their group unnoticed. Nawat was working at his bench when the crows proclaimed the news. "They say that Bronow is with them," he told Ali. She helped him by holding a piece of leather flat on the bench while Nawat cut it up for laces.
"The hawk is coming."
Ali nodded. "I have to let go," she warned him. Nawat sat back. Ali released the leather, then ran to report first to the Duchess. Winamine took Ali to the Duke, who was reviewing the harvest totals.
"We'll let him in. Bronow can relax and tell his side of the story. I want to hear what he has to say," he told Ali and his wife. "We owe him that, and I'm sure he will do the right thing once he's had a chance to think it over."
Ali carried word to Chenaol and thus to Sarai and Dove, who were helping the cook to strain seeds from newly made jelly. To their credit, the girls finished their tasks before they raced to their rooms to change clothes and to move things so their parents could sleep on the third story with them. Bronow would have Winamine's and Mequin's rooms, but the fourth floor was no longer available to his men-at-arms as it was full of winter stores. Even Bronow would not suspect his friends did not want his soldiers living among them. Instead, they would sleep in one of the new buildings under Veron's eye. Ali was cleaned up and wearing a dress by the time Bronow entered the great hall. Mequin and Winamine waited there to meet him, as did Sarai. Dove had refused to greet the traitor, using words just that blunt. From her position behind Sarai, Ali watched as Bronow handed his outer coat and gloves to one of the house slaves. He approached his friends with his ready smile.
"So grim," he said teasingly. "Whatever can you have heard?"
He kissed Winamine on both cheeks and gave Mequin a man's brisk hug. He took Sarai's hand and kissed her fingers with comic elegance, his raised brows and twinkling eyes drawing a smile from her in spite of herself.
"We've heard dreadful things, my lord," she explained shyly.
"Come up to our rooms and talk," offered Mequin. "Ali, refreshments, please."
Ali curtsied and went to the kitchen. Chenaol had already assembled a tray for her.
10 men-at-arms, Fezgau says, the cook reported in a whisper for Ali's ears alone. "They've been riding hard. If 10's all he's got, his grace could simply kill them all and ship Bronow back to Rajmuat, or kill Bronow and send his pickled head to the regents. It's a good way to make sure there's no more trouble."
"The Duke wants to keep it friendly,"
Ochebu said icily. She was seated at a table, clutching a mug of tea with knobby fingers.
"Whoever heard of a Luaran that wasn't ready to shed the blood of others? This is a fine time to have such qualms, when killing the Jimajen prince would simplify things."
Ali grimaced. "Things are not precisely friendly between him and the prince," she pointed out, though privately she agreed that their lives would be far easier if Bronow and his men were dead. The Duke was not that kind of person, however. "His Grace says that if Bronow grovels a bit, it will be all right. He says Rubinyan would never order the death of his own brother. We're to wait and see."
"The Duke's too good for this, you know," Chenaol said, glaring at Ochebu. "For that Luaran snake bit they call the royal court, he always was."
"He's soft," the old mage said harshly, "and he doesn't know anything about the House of Jimajen. They will turn on him with a smile and a razor in their hands."
"Ali?"
Locage stood at the kitchen door, beckoning. Ali went to him.
"Something's off," whispered the hostler. "None of these came with him before, not the men, not the horses, and he's brought no body servants. Warn the Duke."
Ali nodded and took the tray from Chenaol. The change in attendance could be entirely harmless. Perhaps Bronow hadn't cared to burden himself with body servants when he was on the run. Perhaps they'd been captured. Perhaps his usual warriors had been unable to follow him when he escaped Rajmuat. "I hate perhapses when lives are at stake," she thought as she climbed the stairs, "and I'd as soon handle a jar of acid on a bumpy road than try to guess what folly Bronow will commit next. Once more she poured out wine for everyone in the Duke's sitting room, even Sarai. She also murmured Locage's news into the Duke's ear as she served him. Mequin nodded and gestured for her to take her place behind the Duchess.
"You can speak before Ali," the Duke assured Bronow. "Whom would she tell it to? The grass?"
Bronow smirked at Ali, then addressed his friends.
There was something wrong in Hazar in dying so unexpectedly. I don't suspect my brother, of course, he said, grinning, holding up a hand to stop the protest he expected Mequen to make. Imogene, though, she doesn't show the madness. But would you care to wager that it skipped her and got every other member of the Ritavan family?
Even Donovan?
Asked Winamine with a smile, offering Bronow the pastry dish. He accepted one and wolfed it down. Ali wondered when he had eaten last.
Oh, who knows? Asked Bronow. He's only 3, poor lad.
Weena, it would break your heart the way they keep him. No boy's his own age in that tomb of a chamber, their servants in place of his... I'd never use a child of my blood, so...
He glanced sidelong at Sarai, who ducked her head shyly.
But Imogene is as cold as the ocean deeps. It would never occur to her that Donivan's a child more than he's a king.
But you tried to kidnap that king, Mequen said gently.
Bruno, Rubinyan has written to us.
Ah, said the prince. So that is why you regard me with such reserve today. It was a rash act, I see that now. I wasn't thinking of anything but getting the boy to safety. If they killed a reigning king, will they stop at murdering a child?
I cannot believe Rubinyan would be a part of either crime, Mequen replied stiffly.
Bronow hung his head.
No, no, of course not.
He turned his feverish eyes on Winamine.
Don't you find it suspicious that Hazarine's servants and healer vanished all at once? I'll wager they could tell some stories.
These are all good points, said Mequen. But until the charges against you are dismissed, you can only sow disorder with such talk.
Nothing about him suggested that he knew the true fate of Hazarin's servant, Sanhealer.
You must answer to the king's council and clear your name. If the misunderstanding cannot be dismissed, Rubinyan may have to make some gesture, send you into exile, perhaps, or imprison you at the stronghold. But your friends will seek your pardon.
Return and stand trial, suggested Winamine. You'll slip the rug out from under them. By running, you'll only create more doubt in people's minds. Once the council sees and hears you, and knows you felt that you did your duty by the crown, I think you'll find more allies than you suspect.
Bronow chewed on a fingernail, the picture of a guilty child.
Do you truly think so?
Of course, Winamine replied, resting a hand on his arm. Men on the hunt for other men. Such hunters do make mistakes, Mequen reminded his friend. If you are caught, if you fight, some dreadful accident might happen. You might be killed by an overzealous armsman before you can speak to the council at all.
Ali refilled glasses as the conversation went on. Daylight faded into sunset. Mequen and Winamine came at Bronow in close order, persuading, joking, and debating. They did all they could to sow a gentler, more thoughtful mood in their rash friend. The turning point came when Bronow looked at Sarai.
"And what of you?" he asked. "Do you think I am a criminal?"
She lowered her eyes.
"My lord, how could I think you a criminal? It is your life I fear for."
Her eyelashes fluttered like butterflies.
"And your future," she added in a shy whisper.
Oh, she's good, thought Ali in admiration, remembering Sarai's fury when she heard of Bronow's kidnapping attempt. She's very good. I could turn opponents to her queenship right around by just giving her time to work on them.
Mequen eyed his daughter and his friend. At last the silence created by Sarai was finally broken by the supper bell.
Mequen asked, "Will it help if I go to Rajmuat with you? Rubinyan will listen to me, I think, and the two of us can talk to Imogene."
"Papa!"
cried Sarai, alarmed out of her maidenly distress.
"My dear, I don't think you could return before the passes close for the winter,"
Winamine said, her hands clenched in her lap.
"This is more important,"
Mequen explained gravely to his wife and daughter.
"If only one of us goes to Rajmuat, it won't seem as if we are forcing our way back into favor. If I must wait to return until spring," he shrugged.
Bronow stared at Mequen.
You would do that for me? They could arrest you. I don't believe Rubinyan will allow that, and yes, I will go, if it helps to ease the trouble between the two of you, replied Mequen, his gaze sober. The realm needs you and Rubinyan both. We can't afford dissent in the family that rules the Isles, not with a child on the throne and our Karthaki friends eyeing us like a ripe plum to be picked.
Of your goodwill, give me a day to discuss it with my people, he said, voice and body weary.
They have been with me over many hard miles. They deserve a chance to decide if they will return and share whatever happens to me. Of course you may have the time, Mequen said, getting to his feet. He went to Bronow, who stood and embraced him. And you should rest before you return. You look worn to the bone.
Bronow looked at Mequen, then at Winamin and Sarai, obviously puzzled.
It hasn't occurred to you, has it? He asked.
Should anything happen to Don Ivan, you would be king. You?
Mequen put a hand over his friend's mouth.
Please don't speak of that again, he said gently. Ever. Haven't you noticed? Kingship in the Copper Isles drives people mad. I don't want it, for myself or my family. And in case you've forgotten, when I first married, the king had me swear before Mithros that I would never seek the crown. I keep my word.
Bronow hugged Mequen impulsively.
You were always better than the rest of us, he said, his voice thick.
He let Mequen go and stepped back.
Now, where may I clean up? I must tell you I haven't had a true meal in days.
Ali took Bronow to the Duke's bedchamber, where he would sleep as he had on his last visit. Once he was supplied with hot water, soap, and drying cloths, Ali returned to the family. The door was unlatched. She entered the room to find that Sarai had gone. The Duke and the Duchess were in each other's arms.
I'm sorry, Ali said when they looked at her.
The Duchess had been crying. She muttered an apology and went to the washstand to splash water on her face.
It's all right, Mequen replied.
With Bronow no longer in view, the Duke's true feelings were easier to read. His shoulders drooped, and the lines on his face were deep with care.
We must go downstairs in a moment, in any case.
Ali hesitated. What she had to say would distress him, but she needed to say it.
Forgive me, Your Grace, but should you not make him swear before the god to behave, to abide by your direction? She asked, trying to tell him to do it without making it a direct order.
She didn't think they trusted her enough to accept orders, even if she went against her training and gave them.
If he panics, there's no telling what he might do. An oath would rein him in.
Mequen sighed.
Ali, if you were noble-born, you would know that would be an intolerable insult to an honorable man like Bronow. To ask for such a vow implies I do not trust him. Do you wish to spark the very kind of outburst that got him into this mess? Leave the nobility to handle the nobility.
Ali blinked at him. Just once she wished she could speak her mind to tell him that she too was noble-born, and some nobles could not be trusted as far as they could be thrown. She was sorely tempted to point out to him that turbaned blood was bluer than that of any Kiprish Luaran. Instead, she put such unwise answers from her mind, came about, and tried another tack.
Your Grace, he has a point. They might well imprison you if you returned.
I would, she thought, but did not say aloud.
Mequen shook his head.
Rubinyan and I have been friends since boyhood. He would never do such a thing.
When Ali opened her mouth again, he raised a hand to silence her.
Enough of plots and plotting. Don't you have the wine service at supper?
Ali had been dismissed. Never mind that I speak for the god, she thought with a mental sigh. Never mind that I'm trying to keep him and his family from harm. Ali turned and left the room without so much as a curtsy to her master.
Chapter 16. Betrayal.
Ali woke the next morning with the other servants, having taken forever to sleep the night before. Yawning, she rolled her pallet and stored it, then cleaned up for the day. Once presentable, she joined the line for breakfast. Chenaol was serving. When Ali reached the cook, she asked Chenaol to remind everyone to watch Bronow and his people.
That's easy enough, Chen Aol said dryly, keeping her voice soft. They amble about the courtyards like this was a friendly visit.